We must dispose of about the amount of time it ought to take to go to the little hamlet of Ablasour and put justice on the track of those murderers and get back home again. And meantime, I had an auxiliary interest, which had never paled yet, never lost its novelty for me since I had been in Arthur's kingdom. The behavior, born of nice and exact subdivisions of caste, of chance passers-by toward each other. Toward the shaven monk who trudged along with his cowl tilted back and the sweat washing down his fat jowls. The coal-burner was deeply reverent. To the gentleman, he was abject. With the small farmer and the free mechanic, he was cordial and gossipy. And when a slave passed by with a countenance respectfully lowered, this chap's nose was in the air. He couldn't even see him. Well, there are times when one would like to hang the whole human race and finish the farce. Presently, we struck an incident. A small mob of half-naked boys and girls came tearing out of the woods, scared and shrieking. The eldest among them were not more than 12 or 14 years old. They implored help, but they were so beside themselves that we couldn't make out what the matter was. However, we plunged into the wood, they scurrying in the lead, and the trouble was quickly revealed. They had hanged a little fellow with a bark rope, and he was kicking and struggling in the process of choking to death. We rescued him and fetched him around. It was some more human nature, the admiring little folk imitating their elders. They were playing mob, and had achieved a success which promised to be a good deal more serious than they had bargained for. It was not a dull excursion for me. I managed to put in the time very well. I made various acquaintanceships, and in my quality of stranger was able to ask as many questions as I wanted to. A thing which naturally interested me, as a statesman, was the matter of wages. I picked up what I could under that head during the afternoon. A man who hasn't had much experience and doesn't think is apt to measure a nation's prosperity or lack of prosperity by the mere size of the prevailing wages. If the wages be high, the nation is prosperous. If low, it isn't, which is an error. It isn't what sum you get, it's how much you can buy with it. That's the important thing. And it's that that tells whether your wages are high in fact or only high in name. I could remember how it was in the time of our great civil war in the 19th century. In the North, a carpenter got $3 a day gold valuation. In the South, he got 50, payable in Confederate shin plasters worth $1 a bushel. In the North, a suit of overalls cost $3, a day's wages. In the South, it cost 75, which was 2 days' wages. Other things were in proportion. Consequently, wages were twice as high in the North as they were in the South, because the one wage had that much more purchasing power than the other had. Yes, I made various acquaintances in the hamlet, and a thing that gratified me a good deal was to find our new coins in circulation. Lots of milrays, lots of mills, lots of cents, a good many nickels, and some silver. All this among the artisans and commonalty, generally. Yes, and even some gold. But that was at the bank, that is to say, the goldsmiths. I dropped in there while Marco, the son of Marco, was haggling with a shopkeeper over a quarter of a pound of salt, and asked for change for a $20 gold piece. They furnished it, that is, after they had chewed the piece and rung it on the counter and tried acid on it and asked me where I got it and who I was and where I was from and where I was going to and when I expected to get there and perhaps a couple of hundred more questions. And when they got aground, I went right on and furnished them a lot of information voluntarily. Told them I owned a dog and his name was Watch. And my first wife was a free-will Baptist, and her grandfather was a prohibitionist, and I used to know a man who had two thumbs on each hand and a wart on the inside of his upper lip, and died in the hope of a glorious resurrection, and so on and so on and so on, till even that hungry village questioner began to look satisfied and also a shade put out. But he had to respect a man of my financial strength, and so he didn't give me any lip. But I noticed he took it out of his underlings, which was a perfectly natural thing to do. Yes, they changed my 20, but I judged it strained the bank a little, which was the thing to be expected, for it was the same as walking into a paltry village store in the 19th century and requiring the boss of it to change a $2,000 bill for you all of a sudden. He could do it, maybe, but at the same time he would wonder how a small farmer happened to be carrying so much money around in his pocket. Which was probably this goldsmith's thought, too, for he followed me to the door and stood there gazing after me with reverent admiration. Our new money was not only handsomely circulating, but its language was already glibly in use. That is to say, people had dropped the names of the former monies and spoke of things as being worth so many dollars or cents, or mills or milrays now. It was very gratifying. We were progressing, that was sure. I got to know several master mechanics, but about the most interesting fellow among them was the blacksmith, Dowley. He was a live man and a brisk talker, and had 2 journeymen and 3 apprentices, and was doing a raging business. In fact, he was getting rich, hand over fist, and was vastly respected. Marco was very proud of having such a man for a friend. He had taken me there ostensibly to let me see the big establishment, which bought so much of his charcoal, but really to let me see what easy and almost familiar terms he was on with this great man. Dowley and I fraternized at once. I had had just such picked men, splendid fellows, under me in the Colt Arms factory. I was bound to see more of him, so I invited him to come out to Marco's Sunday and dine with us. Marco was appalled and held his breath, and when the grandee accepted, he was so grateful that he almost forgot to be astonished at the condescension. Marco's joy was exuberant, but only for a moment. Then he grew thoughtful, then sad, and when he heard me tell Dowley I should have Dickon, the boss mason, and Smug, the boss wheelwright, out there too, the coal dust on his face turned to chalk, and he lost his grip. But I knew what was the matter with him. It was the expense. He saw ruin before him. He judged that his financial days were numbered. However, on our way to invite the others, I said, "You must allow me to have these friends come, and you must also allow me to pay the costs." His face cleared, and he said with spirit, "But not all of it, not all of it. You cannot well bear a burden like to this alone." I stopped him and said, "Now let's understand each other on the spot, old friend. I am only a farm bailiff, it is true, but I am not poor, nevertheless. I have been very fortunate this year. You would be astonished to know how I have thriven. I tell you the honest truth when I say I could squander away as many as a dozen feasts like this and never care that for the expense," and I snapped my fingers. I could see myself rise a foot at a time in Marco's estimation, and when I fetched out those last words, I was become a very tower for style and altitude. "So you see, you must let me have my way. You can't contribute a cent to this orgy. That's settled."
"It's grand and good of you."
"No, it isn't. You've opened your house to Jones and me in the most generous way. Jones was remarking upon it today, just before you came back from the village. For although he wouldn't be likely to say such a thing to you, because Jones isn't a talker and is diffident in society, he has a good heart and a grateful, and knows how to appreciate it when he is well treated. Yes, you and your wife have been very hospitable toward us."
"Ach, brother, 'tis nothing. Such hospitality."
"But it is something. The best a man has, freely given, is always something, and is as good as a prince can do, and ranks right along beside it. For even a prince can do but his best. And so we'll shop around and get up this layout now, and don't you worry about the expense. I'm one of the worst spendthrifts that ever was born. Why, do you know, sometimes in a single week I spend... But never mind about that. You'd never believe it anyway. And so we went, gadding along, dropping in here and there, pricing things, and gossiping with the shopkeepers about the riot, and now and then running across pathetic reminders of it, and the persons of shunned and tearful and houseless remnants of families whose homes had been taken from them, and their parents butchered or hanged. The raiment of Marco and his wife was of coarse tow linen and linsey woolsey, respectively, and resembled township maps, it being made up pretty exclusively of patches which had been added, township by township, in the course of 5 or 6 years, until hardly a hand's breadth of the original garments was surviving and present. Now, I wanted to fit these people out with new suits, on account of that swell company, and I didn't know just how to get at it, with delicacy, until at last it struck me that as I had already been liberal in inventing wordy gratitude for the king, it would be just the thing to back it up with evidence of a substantial sort. So I said, "And Marco, there's another thing which you must permit, out of kindness for Jones, because he wouldn't want to offend him. He was very anxious to testify his appreciation in some way, but he is so diffident he couldn't venture it himself. And so he begged me to buy some little things and give them to you and Dame Phyllis and let him pay for them without your ever knowing they came from him. You know how a delicate person feels about that sort of thing." And so I said I would, and we would keep mum. Well, his idea was a new outfit of clothes for you both.
Oh, it is wastefulness. It may not be, brother. It may not be. Consider the vastness of the sum.
Hang the vastness of the sum. Try to keep quiet for a moment and see how it would seem. A body can't get in a word edgeways, you talk so much. You ought to cure that, Marco. It isn't good form, you know, and it'll grow on you if you don't check it. Yes, we'll step in here now and price this man's stuff, and don't forget to remember to not let on to Jones that you know he had anything to do with it. You can't think how curiously sensitive and proud he is. He's a farmer, pretty fairly well-to-do farmer, and I'm his bailiff. But the imagination of that man, why, sometimes when he forgets himself and gets to blowing off, you'd think he was one of the swells of the earth. And you might listen to him 100 years and never take him for a farmer, especially if he talked agriculture. He thinks he's a sheel of a farmer, thinks he's old Grayback from way back. But between you and me, privately, he don't know as much about farming as he does about running a kingdom. Still, whatever he talks about, you want to drop your underjaw and listen. The same as if you had never heard such incredible wisdom in all your life before, and were afraid you might die before you got enough of it. That'll please Jones. It tickled Marco to the marrow to hear about such an odd character, but it also prepared him for accidents. And in my experience, when you travel with a king who is letting on to be something else and can't remember it more than about half the time, you can't take too many precautions. This was the best store we had come across yet. It had everything in it, in small quantities, from anvils and dry goods all the way down to fish and pinchbeck jewelry. I concluded I would bunch my whole invoice right here and not go pricing around anymore. So I got rid of Marco by sending him off to invite the mason and the wheelwright, which left the field free to me. For I never care to do a thing in a quiet way. It's got to be theatrical, or I don't take any interest in it. I showed up money enough, in a careless way, to corral the shopkeeper's respect, and then I wrote down a list of the things I wanted and handed it to him to see if he could read it. He could, and was proud to show that he could. He said he had been educated by a priest and could both read and write. He ran it through and remarked with satisfaction that it was a pretty heavy bill. Well, and so it was, for a little concern like that. I was not only providing a swell dinner, but some odds and ends of extras. I ordered that the things be carted out and delivered at the dwelling of Marco, the son of Marco, by Saturday evening, and send me the bill at dinner-time Sunday. He said I could depend upon his promptness and exactitude. It was the rule of the house. He also observed that he would throw in a couple of Miller guns for the Marcos gratis, that everybody was using 'em now. He had a mighty opinion of that clever device. I said, "And please fill them up to the middle mark, too, and add that to the bill." He would, with pleasure. He filled 'em, and I took 'em with me. I couldn't venture to tell him that the Miller gun was a little invention of my own, and that I had officially ordered that every shopkeeper in the kingdom keep them on hand and sell them at government price, which was the merest trifle, and the shopkeeper got that, not the government. We furnished them for nothing. The king had hardly missed us when we got back at nightfall. He had early dropped again into his dream of a grand invasion of Gaul, with the whole strength of his kingdom at his back, and the afternoon had slipped away without his ever coming to himself again. Chapter 32. Dowley's Humiliation. Well, when that cargo arrived toward sunset Saturday afternoon, I had my hands full to keep the Marcos from fainting. They were sure Jones and I were ruined past help, and they blamed themselves as accessories to this bankruptcy. You see, in addition to the dinner materials, which called for a sufficiently round sum, I had bought a lot of extras for the future comfort of the family. For instance, a big lot of wheat, a delicacy as rare to the tables of their class as was ice cream to a hermit's, also a sizable deal dinner table, also 2 entire pounds of salt, which was another piece of extravagance in those people's eyes, also crockery, stools, the clothes, a small cask of beer, and so on. I instructed the Marcos to keep quiet about this sumptuousness, so as to give me a chance to surprise the guests and show off a little. Concerning the new clothes, the simple couple were like children. They were up and down all night to see if it wasn't nearly daylight so they could put them on, and they were into them at last as much as an hour before dawn was due. Then their pleasure, not to say delirium, was so fresh and novel and inspiring that the sight of it paid me well for the interruptions which my sleep had suffered. The king had slept just as usual, like the dead. The Marcos could not thank him for their clothes, that being forbidden, but they tried every way they could think of to make him see how grateful they were, which all went for nothing. He didn't notice any change. It turned out to be one of those rich and rare fall days, which is just a June day, toned down to a degree where it is heaven to be out of doors. Toward noon, the guests arrived, and we assembled under a great tree, and were soon as sociable as old acquaintances. Even the king's reserve melted a little, though it was some little trouble to him to adjust himself to the name of Jones along at first. I had asked him to try to not forget that he was a farmer, but I had also considered it prudent to ask him to let the thing stand at that, and not elaborate it any. Because he was just the kind of person you could depend on to spoil a little thing like that if you didn't warn him. His tongue was so handy, and his spirit so willing, and his information so uncertain. Dowley was in fine feather, and I early got him started, and then adroitly worked him around onto his own history for a text, and himself for a hero, and then it was good to sit there and hear him hum. Self-made man, you know. They know how to talk. They do deserve more credit than any other breed of men, yes, that is true, and they are among the very first to find it out, too. He told how he had begun life an orphan lad without money and without friends able to help him, how he had lived as the slaves of the meanest master lived, how his day's work was from 16 to 18 hours long, and yielded him only enough black bread to keep him in a half-fed condition, how his faithful endeavors finally attracted the attention of a good blacksmith, who came near knocking him dead with kindness by suddenly offering, when he was totally unprepared, to take him as his bound apprentice for 9 years and give him board and clothes and teach him the trade, or mystery, as Dowley called it. That was his first great rise, his first gorgeous stroke of fortune, and you saw that he couldn't yet speak of it without a sort of eloquent wonder and delight that such a gilded promotion should have fallen to the lot of a common human being. He got no new clothing during his apprenticeship, but on his graduation day his master tricked him out in spang new tow linens and made him feel unspeakably rich and fine. "I remember me of that day," the wheelwright sang out with enthusiasm.
"And I likewise," cried the mason. "I would not believe they were thine own. In faith I could not."
"Nor other," shouted Dowley with sparkling eyes. "I was like to lose my character, the neighbors wending I had mayhap been stealing. It was a great day, a great day. One forgetteth not days like that."
Yes, and his master was a fine man and prosperous, and always had a great feast of meat twice in the year, and with it white bread, true wheaten bread. In fact, lived like a lord, so to speak. And in time, Dowley succeeded to the business and married the daughter.
"And now consider what has come to pass," said he impressively. "Two times in every month there is fresh meat upon my table."
He made a pause here to let that fact sink home, then added, "And 8 times salt meat."
"It is even true," said the wheelwright with bated breath.
"I know it of mine own knowledge," said the mason in the same reverent fashion.
"On my table appeareth white bread every Sunday in the year," added the master smith with solemnity. "I leave it to your own consciences, friends, if this is not also true."
"By my head, yes," cried the mason.
"I can testify it, and I do," said the wheelwright.
"And as to furniture, ye shall say yourselves what mine equipment is."
He waved his hand in fine gesture of granting frank and unhampered freedom of speech, and added, "Speak as ye would speak, and I were not here.
Ye have 5 stools, and of the sweetest workmanship at that, albeit your family is but 3."
said the wheelwright with deep respect.
"And 6 wooden goblets, and 6 platters of wood, and 2 of pewter, to eat and drink from withal," said the mason impressively. "And I say it as knowing God is my judge, and we tarry not here alway, but must answer at the last day for the things said in the body, be they false or be they sooth.
Now ye know what manner of man I am, Brother Jones," said the smith with a fine and friendly condescension, "and doubtless ye would look to find me a man jealous of his due of respect, on but sparing of outgo to strangers till their rating and quality be assured. But trouble yourself not as concerning that. Wit ye well ye shall find me a man that regardeth not these matters, but is willing to receive any he as his fellow and equal, that carrieth a right heart in his body, be his worldly estate howsoever modest. And in token of it here is my hand, and I say with my own mouth, we are equals, equals."
And he smiled around on the company with the satisfaction of a god, who is doing the handsome and gracious thing, and is quite well aware of it. The king took the hand with a poorly disguised reluctance, and let go of it as willingly as a lady lets go of a fish, all of which had a good effect, for it was mistaken for an embarrassment natural to one who was being called upon by greatness. The dame brought out the table now and set it under the tree. It caused a visible stir of surprise, it being brand new and a sumptuous article of deal. But the surprise rose higher still when the dame, with a body oozing easy indifference at every pore, but eyes that gave it all away by absolutely flaming with vanity, slowly unfolded an actual Simon Pure tablecloth and spread it. That was a notch above even the blacksmith's domestic grandeurs, and it hit him hard. You could see it. But Marco was in paradise. You could see that, too. Then the dame brought two fine new stools. Whew! That was a sensation. It was visible in the eyes of every guest. Then she brought two more, as calmly as she could. Sensation again, with awed murmurs. Again, she brought two. Walking on air, she was so proud. The guests were petrified, and the mason muttered,
"There is that about earthly pomps, which doth ever move to reverence."
As the dame turned away, Marco couldn't help slapping on the climax while the thing was hot. So he said, with what was meant for a languid composure but was a poor imitation of it,
"These suffice. Leave the rest."
So there was more yet. It was a fine effect. I couldn't have played the hand better myself. From this out, the madam piled up the surprises with a rush that fired the general astonishment up to 150 in the shade, and at the same time paralyzed expression of it down to gasped "ohs" and "ahs" and mute uplifting of hands and eyes. She fetched crockery, new and plenty of it, new wooden goblets and other table furniture, and beer, fish, chicken, a goose, eggs, roast beef, roast mutton, a ham, a small roast pig, and a wealth of genuine white wheaten bread. Take it by and large, that spread laid everything far and away in the shade that ever that crowd had seen before. And while they sat there, just simply stupefied with wonder and awe, I sort of waved my hand, as if by accident, and the storekeeper's son emerged from space and said he had come to collect. "That's all right," I said indifferently. "What is the amount? Give us the items." Then he read off this bill, while those three amazed men listened, and serene waves of satisfaction rolled over my soul, and alternate waves of terror and admiration surged over Marco's. He ceased. There was a pale and awful silence. Not a limb stirred, not a nostril betrayed the passage of breath. "Is that all?" I asked, in a voice of the most perfect calmness.
"All, fair sir, save that certain matters of light moment are placed together under a head-height sundries. If it would like you, I will
"It is of no consequence," I said, accompanying the words with a gesture of the most utter indifference. "Give me the grand total, please." The clerk leaned against the tree to stay himself and said,
39,150 milrays."
The wheelwright fell off his stool. The others grabbed the table to save themselves, and there was a deep and general ejaculation of,
"God be with us in the day of disaster."
The clerk hastened to say,
"My father chargeth me to say he cannot honorably require you to pay it all at this time, and therefore only prayeth you."
I paid no more heed than if it were the idle breeze, but with an air of indifference amounting almost to weariness, got out my money and tossed $4 onto the table. Ah, you should have seen them stare. The clerk was astonished and charmed. He asked me to retain one of the dollars as security until he could go to town, and I interrupted. "What, and fetch back 9 cents? Nonsense. Take the whole. Keep the change." There was an amazed murmur to this effect.
"Verily, this being is made of money. He throweth it away, even as if it were dirt."
The blacksmith was a crushed man. The clerk took his money and reeled away drunk with fortune. I said to Marco and his wife, "Good folk, here is a little trifle for you," handing the miller guns as if it were a matter of no consequence, though each of them contained 15 cents in solid cash. And while the poor creatures went to pieces with astonishment and gratitude, I turned to the others and said as calmly as one would ask the time of day, "Well, if we were all ready, I judge the dinner is. Come, fall to." Ah, well, it was immense. Yes, it was a daisy. I don't know that I ever put a situation together better or got happier, spectacular effects out of the materials available. The blacksmith, well, he was simply mashed. Land, I wouldn't have felt what that man was feeling for anything in the world. Here he had been blowing and bragging about his grand meat feast twice a year, and his fresh meat twice a month, and his salt meat twice a week, and his white bread every Sunday the year round, all for a family of three. The entire cost for the year, not above 69 cents, 2 mills, and 6 milrays. And all of a sudden here comes along a man who slashes out nearly $4 on a single blowout. And not only that, but acts as if it made him tired to handle such small sums. Yes, Dowley was a good deal wilted and shrunk up and collapsed. He had the aspect of a bladder balloon that's been stepped on by a cow. Chapter 33. Sixth Century Political Economy. However, I made a dead set at him, and before the first third of the dinner was reached, I had him happy again. It was easy to do, in a country of ranks and castes. You see, in a country where they have ranks and castes, a man isn't ever a man. He is only part of a man. He can't ever get his full growth. You prove your superiority over him in station or rank or fortune, and that's the end of it. He knuckles down. You can't insult him after that. No, I don't mean quite that. Of course you can insult him. I only mean it's difficult. And so, unless you've got a lot of useless time on your hands, it doesn't pay to try. I had the Smith's reverence now, because I was apparently immensely prosperous and rich. I could have had his adoration if I had had some little gimcrack title of nobility. And not only his, but any commoner's in the land. Though he were the mightiest production of all the ages, in intellect, worth, and character, and I bankrupt in all three. This was to remain so, as long as England should exist in the earth. With the spirit of prophecy upon me, I could look into the future and see her erect statues and monuments to her unspeakable Georges and other royal and noble clothes horses, and leave unhonored the creators of this world, after God, Gutenberg, Watt, Arkwright, Whitney, Morse, Stevenson, Bell. The king got his cargo aboard, and then the talk not turning upon battle, conquest, or ironclad duel, he dulled down to drowsiness and went off to take a nap. Mrs. Marco cleared the table, placed the beer keg handy, and went away to eat her dinner of leavings in humble privacy, and the rest of us soon drifted into matters near and dear to the hearts of our sort. Business and wages, of course. At a first glance, things appeared to be exceeding prosperous in this little tributary kingdom, whose lord was King Bagdemagus, as compared with the state of things in my own region. They had the protection system in full force here, whereas we were working along down toward free trade by easy stages and were now about halfway. Before long, Dowley and I were doing all the talking, the others hungrily listening. Dowley, warmed to his work, snuffed an advantage in the air and began to put questions which he considered pretty awkward ones for me, and they did have something of that look. "In your country, brother, what is the wage of a master bailiff, master hind, carter, shepherd, swineherd?" 25 milrays a day, that is to say, a quarter of a cent. The smith's face beamed with joy. He said, "With us they are allowed the double of it. And what may a mechanic get, carpenter, dauber, mason, painter, blacksmith, wheelwright, and the like? On the average, 50 milrays, half a cent a day." "Ho, ho! With us they are allowed 100. With us any good mechanic is allowed 1 cent a day. I count out the tailor, but not the others. They are all allowed 1 cent a day.
and in driving times they get more. Yes, up to 110 and even 15 milrays a day. I've paid 115 myself within the week. Rah for protection, to Sheol with free trade.
And his face shone upon the company like a sunburst. But I didn't scare at all. I rigged up my pile driver and allowed myself 15 minutes to drive him into the earth. Drive him all in. Drive him in till not even the curve of his skull should show above ground. Here is the way I started in on him. I asked, "What do you pay a pound for salt?"
100 milrays.
"We pay 40.
"What do you pay for beef and mutton
when you buy it?" That was a neat hit. It made the color come.
"It varieth somewhat, but not much. One may say 75 milrays the pound."
"We pay 33. "What do you pay for eggs?"
50 milrays the dozen."
"We pay 20.
"What do you pay for beer?"
"It costeth us 8.5 milrays the pint."
"We get it for 4, 25 bottles for a cent."
"What do you pay for wheat?"
"At the rate of 900 milrays the bushel."
"We pay 400.
"What do you pay for a man's tow linen suit?"
13 cents.
"We pay 6.
"What do you pay for a stuff gown for the wife of the laborer or the mechanic?"
"We pay 8 cents far mills."
"Well, observe the difference. You pay 8 cents and 4 mills. We pay only 4 cents. I prepared now to sock it to him. I said, "Look here, dear friend, what's become of your high wages you were bragging so about a few minutes ago?" And I looked around on the company with placid satisfaction, for I had slipped up on him gradually and tied him hand and foot, you see, without his ever noticing that he was being tied at all. "What's become of those noble high wages of yours?"
"I seem to have knocked the stuffing all out of them, it appears to me."
But if you will believe me, he merely looked surprised. That is all. He didn't grasp the situation at all, didn't know he had walked into a trap, didn't discover that he was in a trap. I could have shot him from sheer vexation. With cloudy eye and a struggling intellect, he fetched this out.
"Marry, I seem not to understand. It is proved that our wages be double thine. How then may it be that thou hast knocked therefrom the stuffing? And miscall not the wonderly word, this being the first time under grace and providence of God it hath been granted me to hear it."
Well, I was stunned. Partly with this unlooked-for stupidity on his part, and partly because his fellows so manifestly sided with him and were of his mind, if you might call it mind. My position was simple enough, plain enough. How could it ever be simplified more? However, I must try. "Why, look here, Brother Dowley, don't you see? Your wages are merely higher than ours in name, not in fact."
"Hear him! They are the double. Ye have confessed it yourself."
"Yes, yes, I don't deny that at all. But that's got nothing to do with it. The amount of the wages in mere coins, with meaningless names attached to them to know them by, has got nothing to do with it. The thing is, how much can you buy with your wages? That's the idea. While it is true that with you a good mechanic is allowed about $3.50 a year, and with us only about $1.75,
there, you're confessing it again! You're confessing it again!
Confound it, I've never denied it, I tell you. What I say is this, with us, half a dollar buys more than a dollar buys with you. And therefore it stands to reason, and the commonest kind of common sense, that our wages are higher than yours. He looked dazed, and said despairingly,
"Verily, I cannot make it out. Ye've just said ours are the higher, and with the same breath ye take it back.
Oh, great Scott, isn't it possible to get such a simple thing through your head? Now look here, let me illustrate. We pay 4 cents for a woman's stuff gown, You pay 8 and 4, which is 4 mils more than double. What do you allow a laboring woman who works on a farm? 2 mils a day. Very good. We allow but half as much. We pay her only 1/10 of a cent a day. And
again, you're
Wait. Now, you see, the thing is very simple. This time you'll understand it. For instance, it takes your woman 42 days to earn her gown at 2 mils a day. 7 weeks' work. But ours earns hers in 40 days, 2 days short of 7 weeks. Your woman has a gown and her whole 7 weeks' wages are gone. Ours has a gown and 2 days' wages left to buy something else with. There. Now you understand it. He looked... Well, he merely looked dubious. It's the most I can say. So did the others. I waited to let the thing work. Dowley spoke at last and betrayed the fact that he actually hadn't gotten away from his rooted and grounded superstitions yet. He said with a trifle of hesitancy, But you cannot fail to grant that 2 mils a day is better than one. Shucks. Well, of course, I hated to give it up. So I chanced another flyer. Let us suppose a case. Suppose one of your journeymen goes out and buys the following articles. 1 pound of salt, 1 dozen eggs, 1 dozen pints of beer, 1 bushel of wheat, 1 tow linen suit, 5 pounds of beef, 5 pounds of mutton. The lot will cost him 32 cents. It takes him 32 working days to earn the money, 5 weeks and 2 days. Let him come to us and work 32 days at half the wages. He can buy all those things for a shade under 14.5 cents. They will cost him a shade under 29 days' work, and he will have about half a week's wages over. Carry it through the year. He would save nearly a week's wages every 2 months, your man nothing. Thus saving 5 or 6 weeks' wages in a year, your man not a cent. Now, I reckon you understand that high wages and low wages are phrases that don't mean anything in the world until you find out which of them will buy the most. It was a crusher. But alas, it didn't crush. No, I had to give it up. What those people valued was high wages. It didn't seem to be a matter of any consequence to them whether the high wages would buy anything or not. They stood for protection and swore by it, which was reasonable enough because interested parties had gulled them into the notion that it was protection which had created their high wages. I proved to them that in 1/4 of a century their wages had advanced but 30%, while the cost of living had gone up 100, and that with us, in a shorter time, wages had advanced 40%, while the cost of living had gone steadily down. But it didn't do any good. Nothing could unseat their strange beliefs. Well, I was smarting under a sense of defeat. Undeserved defeat, but what of that? That didn't soften the smart any. And to think of the circumstances. The first statesman of the age, the capablest man, the best informed man in the entire world, the loftiest uncrowned head that had moved through the clouds of any political firmament for centuries, sitting here apparently defeated in argument by an ignorant country blacksmith. And I could see that those others were sorry for me, which made me blush till I could smell my whiskers scorching. Put yourself in my place. Feel as mean as I did, as ashamed as I felt. Wouldn't you have struck below the belt to get even? Yes, you would. It is simply human nature. Well, that is what I did. I am not trying to justify it. I'm only saying that I was mad, and anybody would have done it. Well, when I make up my mind to hit a man, I don't plan out a love tap. No, that isn't my way. As long as I'm going to hit him at all, I'm going to hit him a lifter. And I don't jump at him all of a sudden and risk making a blundering halfway business of it. No, I get away off yonder to one side and work up on him gradually, so that he never suspects that I'm going to hit him at all. And by and by, all in a flash, he's flat on his back. And he can't tell for the life of him how it all happened. That is the way I went for Brother Dowley. I started to talking, lazy and comfortable, as if I was just talking to pass the time, and the oldest man in the world couldn't have taken the bearings of my starting place and guessed where I was going to fetch up. Boys, there's a good many curious things about law and custom and usage and all that sort of thing, when you come to look at it. Yes, and about the drift and progress of human opinion and movement, too. There are written laws, they perish, but there are also unwritten laws. They are eternal. Take the unwritten law of wages. It says they've got to advance, little by little, straight through the centuries. And notice how it works. We know what wages are now, here and there and yonder. We strike an average and say that's the wages of today. We know what the wages were 100 years ago and what they were 200 years ago. That's as far back as we can get, but it suffices to give us the law of progress, the measure and rate of the periodical augmentation. And so, without a document to help us, we can come pretty close to determining what the wages were 300, 400, and 500 years ago. Good, so far. Do we stop there? No. We stop looking backward, we face around, and apply the law to the future. My friends, I can tell you what people's wages are going to be at any date in the future you want to know, for hundreds and hundreds of years.
What, good man, what?
Yes. In 700 years, wages will have risen to 6 times what they are now, here in your region. And farmhands will be allowed 3 cents a day, and mechanics 6.
I would it, I might die now and live then,
interrupted Smug, the wheelwright, with a fine, avaricious glow in his eye. And that isn't all. They'll get their board besides. Such as it is, it won't bloat them. 250 years later, pay attention now, a mechanic's wages will be, mind you, this is law, not guesswork. A mechanic's wages will then be 20 cents a day. There was a general gasp of awed astonishment. Dickon, the mason, murmured with raised eyes and hands,
"More than 3 weeks' pay for 1 day's work."
"Riches, of a truth, yes, riches,"
muttered Marco, his breath coming quick and short with excitement. Wages will keep on rising, little by little, as steadily as a tree grows, and at the end of 340 years more, there'll be at least one country where the mechanic's average wage will be 200 cents a day. It knocked them absolutely dumb. Not a man of them could get his breath for upwards of 2 minutes. Then the coal burner said prayerfully,
"Might I but live to say it."
"It is the income of an earl," said Smug.
"An earl, say ye?" said Dowley. "You could say more than that and speak no lie. There's no earl in the realm of Bagdemagus that hath an income like to that."
"Income of an earl? Poof! It's the income of an angel."
Now then, that is what is going to happen as regards wages. In that remote day, that man will earn, with 1 week's work, that bill of goods which it takes you upwards of 50 weeks to earn now. Some other pretty surprising things are going to happen, too. Brother Dowley, who is it that determines every spring what the particular wage of each kind of mechanic, laborer, and servant shall be for that year? Sometimes the carts, sometimes the town council, but most of all the magistrate. You may say, in general terms, it is the magistrate that fixes the wages. Doesn't ask any of those poor devils to help him fix their wages for them, does he?
That were an idea. The master that's to pay him the money is the one that's rightly concerned in that matter, you will notice.
Yes, but I thought the other man might have some little trifle at stake in it, too, and even his wife and children, poor creatures. The masters are these: nobles, rich men, the prosperous, generally. These few, who do no work, determine what pay the vast hive shall have, who do work. You see? They're a combine, a trade union, to coin a new phrase, who band themselves together to force their lowly brother to take what they choose to give. 1300 years hence, so says the unwritten law, the combine will be the other way, and then how these fine people's posterity will fume and fret and grit their teeth over the insolent tyranny of trade unions. Yes, indeed, the magistrate will tranquilly arrange the wages from now clear away down into the 19th century, and then all of a sudden the wage earner will consider that a couple of thousand years or so is enough of this one-sided sort of thing, and he will rise up and take a hand in fixing his wages himself. He will have a long and bitter account of wrong and humiliation to settle. Do ye believe that he actually will help to fix his own wages? Yes, indeed. And he will be strong and able then. Brave times, of a truth, sneered the prosperous smith. Oh, and there's another detail. In that day, a master may hire a man for only just one day, or one week, or one month at a time, if he wants to.
What?
It's true. Moreover, a magistrate won't be able to force a man to work for a master a whole year on a stretch, whether the man wants to or not. Will there be no law, or sense in that day? Both of 'em, Dowley. In that day a man will be his own property, not the property of magistrate and master. And he can leave town whenever he wants to if the wages don't suit him, and they can't put him in the pillory for it.
Perdition catch such an age, shouted Dowley in strong indignation. An age of dogs, an age barren of reverence for superiors and respect for authority. The pillory!
Oh, wait, brother, say no good word for that institution. I think the pillory ought to be abolished.
A most strange idea. Why?
Well, I'll tell you why. Is a man ever put in the pillory for a capital crime? No. Is it right to condemn a man to a slight punishment for a small offense and then kill him? There was no answer. I had scored my first point. For the first time, the smith wasn't up and ready. The company noticed it. Good effect.
You don't answer, brother. You were about to glorify the pillory a while ago and shed some pity on a future age that isn't going to use it.
I think the pillory ought to be abolished. What usually happens when a poor fellow was put in the pillory for some little offense that didn't amount to anything in the world? The mob try to have some fun with him, don't they?
Yes.
They begin by clodding him, and they laugh themselves to pieces to see him try to dodge one clod and get hit with another?
Yes.
Then they throw dead cats at him, don't they?
Yes.
Well, then, suppose he has a few personal enemies in that mob, and here and there a man or a woman with a secret grudge against him. And suppose especially that he is unpopular in the community, for his pride or his prosperity or one thing or another. Stones and bricks take the place of clods and cats presently, don't they?
There is no doubt of it.
As a rule, he is crippled for life, isn't he? Jaws broken, teeth smashed out, or legs mutilated, gangrened, presently cut off, or an eye knocked out, maybe both eyes?
It is true, God knoweth it.
And if he is unpopular, he can depend on dying. Right there in the stocks, can he?
He surely can. One may not deny it.
I take it none of you are unpopular, by reason of pride or insolence or conspicuous prosperity, or any of those things that excite envy and malice among the base scum of a village. You wouldn't think it much of a risk to take a chance in the stocks? Dowley winced visibly. I judged he was hit. But he didn't betray it by any spoken word. As for the others, they spoke out plainly and with strong feeling.
They said they had seen enough of the stocks to know what a man's chance in them was, and they would never consent to enter them if they could compromise on a quick death by hanging. Well, to change the subject, for I think I've established my point that the stocks ought to be abolished, I think some of our laws are pretty unfair. For instance, if I do a thing which ought to deliver me to the stocks, and you know I did it, and yet keep still and don't report me, you will get the stocks if anybody informs on you. Ah, but that would serve you but right, said Dowley, for you must inform. So saith the law. The others coincided. Well, all right, let it go, since you vote me down. But there's one thing which certainly isn't fair. The magistrate fixes a mechanic's wage at 1 cent a day, for instance. The law says that if any master shall venture, even under utmost press of business, to pay anything over that cent a day, even for a single day, he shall be both fined and pilloried for it. And whoever knows he did it and doesn't inform, they also shall be fined and pilloried. Now it seems to me unfair, Dowley, and a deadly peril to all of us, that because you thoughtlessly confessed a while ago that within a week you have paid a cent and 15 mil. Oh, I tell you, it was a smasher. You ought to have seen them to go to pieces, the whole gang. I had just slipped up on poor, smiling, and complacent Dowley so nice and easy and softly that he never suspected anything was going to happen till the blow came crashing down and knocked him all to rags. A fine effect. In fact, as fine as any I ever produced, with so little time to work it up in. But I saw in a moment that I had overdone the thing a little. I was expecting to scare them, but I wasn't expecting to scare them to death. They were mighty near it, though. You see, they had been a whole lifetime learning to appreciate the pillory, and to have that thing staring them in the face, and every one of them distinctly at the mercy of me, a stranger. If I chose to go and report, well, it was awful, and they couldn't seem to recover from the shock. They couldn't seem to pull themselves together. Pale, shaky, dumb, pitiful? Why, they weren't any better than so many dead men. It was very uncomfortable. Of course, I thought they would appeal to me to keep mum, and then we would shake hands and take a drink all round and laugh it off and there an end. But no. You see, I was an unknown person, among a cruelly oppressed and suspicious people, a people always accustomed to having advantage taken of their helplessness, and never expecting just or kind treatment from any but their own families and very closest intimates. Appeal to me to be gentle, to be fair, to be generous? Of course they wanted to, but they couldn't dare. Chapter 34. The Yankee and the King Sold as Slaves. Well, what had I better do? Nothing in a hurry, sure. I must get up a diversion, anything to employ me while I could think, and while these poor fellows could have a chance to come to life again. There sat Marco, petrified in the act of trying to get the hang of his Miller gun, turned to stone, just in the attitude he was in when my pile driver fell, the toy still gripped in his unconscious fingers. So I took it from him and proposed to explain its mystery. Mystery. A simple little thing like that, and yet it was mysterious enough for that race and that age. I never saw such an awkward people with machinery. You see, they were totally unused to it. The Miller gun was a little double-barreled tube of toughened glass with a neat little trick of a spring to it, which upon pressure would let a shot escape. But the shot wouldn't hurt anybody, it would only drop into your hand. In the gun were two sizes, wee mustard seed shot, and another sort that were several times larger. They were money. The mustard seed shot represented milrays, the larger ones mills. So the gun was a purse, And very handy, too. You could pay out money in the dark with it, with accuracy. And you could carry it in your mouth or in your vest pocket if you had one. I made them of several sizes, one size so large that it would carry the equivalent of a dollar. Using shot for money was a good thing for the government. The metal cost nothing, and the money couldn't be counterfeited, for I was the only person in the kingdom.